Not your mom. All right. Bye.
My name is Stephen Brooks. I'm an emergency doctor and researcher in the Faculty of Health Sciences at Queen's University. Out-of-hospital cardiac arrest affects about 35,000 people across Canada every year. The sooner treatment begins, the higher the probability of recovery. Neighbors Saving Neighbors is a pilot program to improve survival for people who experience sudden cardiac arrest in Frontenac County. Let us teach you how to do CPR, use an AED, and become a lifesaver. Consider becoming a Neighbors Saving Neighbors volunteer.
Apply today at frontenacparamedics.ca.
Okay, here we go.
Hey, what's up, Kingston?
This is Jimbo.
And you're listening to CFRC 101.9.
Nice.
Yeah.
We nailed that.
We did it.
All right.
Yeah. Great job, guys.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
To introduce myself, I belong to a special tribe of what used to be called troubadours. Sometimes they were called minstrels. Now we're called songwriters. We work for, in our songs, a sort of a better world, a rainbow world. Now my generation, unfortunately, never succeeded in creating that rainbow world, so we can't hand it down to you. But we could hand down our songs, which still hang on to hope and laughter.
Today we pay tribute to the blacklisted lyricist Yip Harbor, the man who put the rainbow in The Wizard of Oz, a Democracy Now! Special. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today we pay tribute to Yip Harburg. His name may not be familiar to many, but his songs are sung by millions around the world.
Like jazz singer Abby Lincoln.
Bing Crosby sang it. Hank Beck played it. And Yip Harburg wrote it. I built a railroad. Against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
And Tom Waits.
From the tower, way up to the sun. And mortar and lime.
Judy Collins and Dr. John from New Orleans. Peter Yarrow.
Hey, don't you remember? Don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al.
That's Al Jolson. And our beloved Odetta.
Don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare down? Can you spare a dime?
Brother, can you spare a dime? May well be a new anthem for many Americans. The lyrics to that classic American song were written by Yip Harburg. He was blacklisted during the McCarthy era. During his career as a lyricist, Yip Harburg used his words to express anti-racist, pro-worker messages. He's best known for writing the lyrics to The Wizard of Oz, the movie that inspired the hit Broadway musical and now the Hollywood blockbuster film Wicked. Yip Harburg also had two hits on Broadway, Bloomer Girls, about the women's suffrage movement, and Finian's Rainbow, a kind of immigrant's anthem about race and class and so much else. Today, in this Democracy Now! Special, we pay tribute to Yip Harburg's life. Ernie Harburg is Yip's son and biographer. He co-wrote the book Who Put the Rainbow in The Wizard of Oz? Yip Harburg, Lyricist.
I met up with Ernie Harburg at the New York Public Library for Performing Arts at Lincoln Center years ago when they were exhibiting Yip Harburg's work. Ernie Harburg took me on a tour.
The first place is some business about words, and one of them is that the songs, when they were written back in those days, anyhow, always had a lyricist and a composer, and neither one of them wrote the song. They both wrote the song. However, in the English language, you know, you have this is Gershwin's song, or this is, they usually say the composer's song. I've rarely ever heard somebody say this is Yip Harburg's song or Ira Gershwin's song. Both of them would be wrong. The fact is, two people write a song. So I'm going to talk about Yip's lyrics and then lyrics in the song. Now, the first thing we're looking at here is an expression, really, of Yip's philosophy and background, which he brings to writing lyrics for the songs. And what it says here is that songs have always been man's anodyne against tyranny and terror. The artist is on the side of humanity. From the time that he was born 100 years ago, in the dire depths of poverty that only the Lower East Side of Manhattan could have, when the Russian Jews, about 2 million of them, got up out of the Russian shettles and ghettos, and the courageous ones came over here and settled in that area, what we now know as the East Village. And Yip knew poverty deeply, and he quoted Bernard Shaw as saying that the chill of poverty never leaves your bones. And it was the basis of Yip's understanding of life as struggle.
Let's go back to how Yip got his start.
Yip was at a very early age interested in poetry, and he used to go to the Tompkins Square Library to read, and the librarians just fed him these things, and he got hooked on every one of the English poets, and especially O. Henry, the ending. He always has a little great ending on the end of each of his songs. And he got hooked on W.S. Gilbert, the Babs Ballad. And then when he went to Townsend High School, they had them sitting in the seats by alphabetical order. So Yip was H and Gershwin was G. So Ira sat next to Yip. One day, Yip walked in with Babs Ballads, and Ira, who was very shy and hardly spoke to anybody, just suddenly lit up and say, "Do you like those?" And they got into a conversation. And Ira then said, "Do you know there's music to them?" And Yip said, "No." He said, "Well, come on home." So they went to Ira's home, which is on 2nd Avenue and 5th Street, which is sort of upper from Yip's poverty at 11 and C. And they had a Victrola, which is like having, you know, a huge instruments today. And he played him HMS Pinafore. Well, Yip was just absolutely flabbergasted, knocked out. And that did it. I mean, for the both of them. Because Ira was intensely interested in it. Began their lifelong friendship. Then Ira went on to be one of the pioneers with 25 other guys, Jewish, Russian immigrants, who developed the American Musical Theater. And it was only after, in 1924, I think, that Ira's first show with George Gershwin, his brother, that they started writing together.
Thank you.
Gershwin's Porgy and Bess in 1940.
Took a kind of detour because when the war, World War One, came, and Yip was a socialist and did not believe in the war, he took a boat down to Uruguay for 3 years. I mean, he refused to fight in the thing. That's shades of 1968 and the Vietnam War, right?
And why didn't he believe in World War One?
Because he was a full, deep-dyed socialist who did not believe that capitalism was the answer to human community, and that indeed it was the destruction of the human spirit, and he would not fight its wars. And at that time, the socialists and the lefties, as they were called, Bolsheviks and everything else, were against the war. So when he came back, he got married, he had two kids, and he went to the electrical appliance business. And all the time, hanging out with Ira and George and Howard Dietz and Buddy DeSilva, and writing light bursts for the FBA conning tower. And the newspapers used to carry light bursts, every newspaper. There were about 25 of them at that time, not two or three now, owned by two people in the world, you know. And they actually carried light bursts. Well, Yip and Ira and Dorothy Parker, the whole crowd had light bursts in there, and they loved it. So when the crash came and Yip's business went under, and he was about anywhere $50,000 to $70,000 in debt, his partner went bankrupt. He didn't. He repaid the loans for the next 20 or 15 years at least. Ira and he agreed that he should start writing lyrics.
Let's talk about what Yip is most known for. Finian's Rainbow, The Wizard of Oz. Right here, what do we have in front of us?
We have a lead sheet. We are in the gallery of the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts. And there's an exhibition called The Necessity of Rainbows, which is the work of Yip Harburg. And we are looking at the lead sheet of Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, which came from a review called Americana, which it was the first review which had a political theme to it. At that time, the notion of the forgotten man. You have to remember what the Great Depression was all about. It's hard to imagine that now. But when Roosevelt said one-third of the nation are ill clothed, ill-housed, and ill-fed, that's exactly what it was. It was at least 30% unemployment at those times. And among blacks and minorities, it was 50, 60%. And there were bread lines. And now the rich, kept living their lifestyle. But Broadway was reduced to about 12 musicals a year, from a prior in the 20s about 50 a year, okay? So it became harder. But the Great Depression was the dominant fact of life in everybody's mind, and all the songs were censored, I use that loosely, by the music publishers. They only wanted love songs or escape songs. So that in 1929 you had Happy Days Are Here Again, and you had all of these kinds of songs. There wasn't one song that addressed the depression in which we were all living. And this show, the Americana show, Yip was asked to write a song or get the lyrics up for a song, which addressed itself to the breadlines, okay? And so he at that time was working very closely with Jay Gorney. Jay had a tune which he had brought over with him when he was 8 years old from Russia, and it was in a minor key, which is a whole different key. Most popular songs are in major. And it was a Russian lullaby. And it was da 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 da. And Jay had, somebody else had lyrics for it. Once I knew a big blonde and she had big blue eyes. She was big blue like that. And it was a torch song, which we talked about. And Yip said, well, could we throw the words out and I'll take the tune? All right. And if you look at Yip's notes, which are in the book that I mentioned, you'll see he started out writing a very satiric, comedic song. At that time, Rockefeller, the ancient one, was going around giving out dimes to people. And Yip had a satiric thing about, can I share my dime with you, you know? But then, right in the middle, other images started coming out in his writings. And you had a man in a mill. And the whole thing turned into the song that we know it now, which is here and which I can read to you. And if you do this song, you have to do the verse, because that's where a lot of the action is.
Can you sing it to me?
All right, I'll try. It won't be as good as Bing Crosby or Tom Waits. They used to tell me I was building a dream.
I was building a dream.
And so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow.
When there was earth to plow.
Or guns to bear. I was always there.
I was always there.
Right on the job.
Right on the job.
They used to tell me I was building a dream. With peace and glory ahead. Why should I
be standing in line?
Just waiting
for bread. Once I built a railroad, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, it's done. Buddy, can you spare a dime?
Yip Harburg singing in 1975.
Once I built a tower to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built that tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
When was this song first played?
In 1932, and in the Americana Review, every critic, everybody took it up, and it swept the nation. In fact, paradoxically, I think Roosevelt and the Democratic Party really wanted to tone it down and keep it off the radio, because playing havoc with trying to not talk about the Depression, which everybody did. You remember the Hoover thing, not only the happy days are here again, but two chickens in every pot and so forth. Nobody wanted to sing about the Depression either, you know.
Yet, Yip Harburg was a supporter of FDR.
Yes, but politics are politics, you know, and the thing was that, in fact, historically, this was, I would say, the only song that addressed itself seriously to the Great Depression, a condition of our lives, which nobody wanted to talk about and nobody wanted to sing about.
Ernie Harburg, son of Yip Harburg. When we come back from our break, we'll talk about The Wizard of Oz, Finian's Rainbow, and other shows.
Times of confusion like these, when all the world is a hopeless jumble, and the raindrops tumble all around, heaven opens a magic lane. When purple clouds darken up the skyway, there's a lovely highway to be found, leading from your window pane to a spot behind the sun, just a step beyond the...
And, oh, let me just say one other thing. Sure. Didn't Elon Musk say on his social media platform X, he just put out CFPB RIP with a tombstone?
Thank you for having me today, Amy. You know, this is really critical for all Americans. The CFPB is the place where Americans could go when they were scammed by a payday lender, or when they couldn't get inaccurate information taken off their credit report, or when big banks like Wells Fargo were opening fake accounts in their name. And the CFPB again and again delivered for American families. This, over its entire history, the CFPB has returned $21 billion to American families. So, you know, this is a little agency that was punching well above its weight. And then just a few days ago, you know, Donald Trump and Elon Musk took control and shut the agency down. So we went from a place where, you know, in the last week before Trump took power, the CFPB was ordering big companies to return millions of dollars to consumers, to a place where the agency is doing nothing at all. And you raised the role of Elon Musk here. I think this is a fact that we really have to focus on. Elon Musk himself wants to run a payments company. He has said from the start that he plans to turn X into essentially a bank. And he's taken steps in that direction in the last few weeks, including a partnership with Visa. The thing that stands in his way is having strong regulators who will make him play by the same rules as every other bank. Luckily, he has access to the entire federal government, and he's able to simply shut those regulators down. So the actions over the last few weeks have been incredibly bad for individual, everyday Americans, but incredibly good for Elon Musk's pocketbook.
And for those people who are not familiar, could you talk a little bit about the battle to get the to create the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau only in the aftermath of the financial meltdown of 2008? Did the Obama administration move to create it? But it's always faced enormous hostility, hasn't it, from the financial, especially from the financial community?
Yeah, that's right. I think it's incredibly important to know that the CFPB was born out of a financial crisis that started in the mortgage markets. So before the 2008 financial crisis, we didn't have a cop on the beat watching what mortgage servicers, particularly non-bank mortgage servicers, were doing. And as a result, we ended up in a massive financial crisis that took us years to dig out of. President Obama, Elizabeth Warren, and others worked together to create the CFPB. It was created in a bipartisan fashion, but it's had a target on its back from the start. And, you know, particularly when I was at CFPB, when we went out and talked to consumers around the country, there was nothing partisan or controversial about the CFPB when it came to the work that it was delivering for Americans. The only place where CFPB is really controversial is in Washington, D.C., with big bank lobbyists and tech company lobbyists. So from the start, they've had a target on CFPB. I think this is one more step in their plan to get rid of the agency, and they've never had more power to be able to dismantle it.
And in terms of the some of the biggest achievements, could you enumerate some of them for our listeners?
Sure. So, you know, CFPB has achieved some really big achievements for individual consumers. I think that our crackdown on Wells Fargo that ended their campaign of issuing fake accounts in people's names is a really big one. But just in the last couple of years, we've had some really big wins for families, including a credit card late fees rule that limited late fees from $30 to $15, a rule that limited overdraft fees to $5. And I think really importantly, taking medical debt off of people's credit reports. So in the time that I was at CFPB, we did a lot of research on the impact of medical debt. And we found that a lot of the medical debt that was being reported on people's credit reports was inaccurate. And then people were being hounded by debt collectors over debts that they didn't owe. So these actions are incredibly consequential for American families, and now they're all being put at risk by Donald Trump and Elon Musk's agenda.
Let's go to Elon Musk. In this very odd news conference, that President Trump sitting at the Resolute desk and Elon Musk standing next to him with his child on his shoulders held. This is Musk.
Democracy. This may seem like, well, aren't we in a democracy? Well, if you don't have a feedback loop, FKX, we'd have to, if you sorry. So the gravitas can be difficult sometimes. So if there's not a good feedback loop from the people to the government, and if you have rule of the bureaucrat, if the bureaucracy is in charge, and then what meaning does democracy actually have?
So, Julie Margetta Morgan, if you could respond to what Elon Musk said at that point, his child just standing next to him.
I think it's incredibly bold for him to stand there and suggest that he's creating a feedback loop between the people and the government. The CFPB itself was a feedback loop between the people and the government. Individuals could actually file a complaint on CFPB's website and have the certainty that the agency was going to, you know, look into that complaint and not only resolve it for them individually, but also look at broader actions by the companies that people complained about and take action through our enforcement or supervision divisions. So Elon Musk is actually doing the opposite of what he's claimed. He's shutting down those feedback loops for people, and he's doing it for his own personal gain.
So, Julie Margetta Morgan, as we wrap up, at this point, how can the CFPB, can it be resurrected? And if you could finally comment on Russell Vogt, the head of the OMB, who was one of the chief architects of Project 2025, how that fits into the shuttering of CFPB.
Yes, Russell Vogt is in charge of the CFPB right now, and he's taking an axe to all of the pieces of CFPB that have been the most helpful for consumers. To your original question, it's not too late for CFPB. I expect that we'll see action in the court. I believe we've already seen a few cases filed here, because I think it's just really important to know that the actions they're taking are illegal. You know, the CFPB is responsible to Congress for completing certain activities, including having a robust supervision program that's kind of like the cop on the beat inside of the largest institutions. And so, you know, as much as they're doing the best that they can to dismantle CFPB right now, these actions are illegal, and I expect we'll see the court step in.
Julie Margetta Morgan, thanks so much for being with us. Former Associate Director for Research, Monitoring, and Regulations at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. She left a few weeks ago. Coming up, are we sleepwalking into autocracy? Stay with us.
The shrimp boats from the time that he was grown, and he scrimped and saved and bought himself a trawler of his own. He was rough and he was ready, and he drank when he was home, and he made his family's living on the Gulf of Mexico. He was paycheck 20 years to Texaco, when he died, we spread his ashes on the Gulf of Mexico. He was rolling, he was rolling across the deep green water.
Gulf of Mexico by Steve Earle. Trump renamed the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America in an executive order and declared February 9th Gulf of America Day. This week, Google and Apple changed the name on their maps for U.S. viewers, while other sources for online maps have not followed suit. And AP says it was blocked from covering the Oval Office because it did not change the name in its AP guidebook from Gulf of Mexico to Gulf of America. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to an expert on autocracy who says the Trump administration's moves to gut the federal government, shape the judiciary, and punish critics are all following a well-known playbook, not just the right-wing policy blueprint known as Project 2025, but the autocratic playbook of Hungary's authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán. Today, in an unprecedented move by a European leader, Orbán hosted the leader of Germany's far-right Alternative for Germany party, AfD, ahead of an election in 2 weeks, even as other Western leaders have sought to contain the party. At least one key member of Trump's new administration has closely studied Orbán, the controversial far-right pundit Sebastian Gorka, who previously worked at the Hungarian Ministry of Defense before Orbán and is now Trump's deputy assistant to the president's senior National Security Council director for counterterrorism, a top post that did not require Senate confirmation. Gorka advised Trump in his first term, but was pushed out after The Forward revealed he once had ties to a Hungarian far-right Nazi-allied group and that he supported an anti-Semitic and racist paramilitary militia in Hungary. This week, Gorka addressed a security forum.
If you share our values, you are on Team Western Civilization. Not just Western Hemisphere, Western Civilization. President Trump stated the following: the only question of our time is if we have the will to defend and save our civilization from those who wish to destroy it. If you believe that, the next 4 years will be beautiful for you and America.
This comes as candidates for top national security positions are now facing questions that appear to be a Trump loyalty test, including whether they accept his false claim that he won the 2020 election. For more, we're joined by Kim Lane Shepley, professor of sociology and international affairs at Princeton University, specializing in the rise and fall of constitutional government, focusing on Hungary. Her recent guest essay for The New York Times is headlined, "Are We Sleepwalking into Autocracy?" Professor Shepley, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you answer your question? What are you seeing in this country as you lived for many years in Hungary and what you saw there?
Yeah, well, so first of all, nice to be back with you. Unfortunately, we're under very difficult circumstances. And so I think it's really important in looking at how democracies fail these days. And the crucial thing to say about Hungary is that it was a robust democracy, sort of top of its class in Eastern Europe in 2010, when Viktor Orban came to power. And by the end of that decade, virtually all of the democracy raters rated it as no longer a democracy. I would say the collapse happened even faster. Really, Orban did almost everything to undermine democracy for Hungary's future just in the first 3 years. So as we're looking at what's happening now in Washington, one of the things we see is this everything, everywhere, all at once attack on all of the pillars of democracy. And that was exactly how Orban did it. Came into power while he'd been out of power for 8 years before he was elected in 2010. He had private law firms, private groups write a blueprint so that when he was, as soon as he took office, he could hit the ground running and just, you know, come out with thousands of pages of laws with all kinds of programs that hit sort of every sector of civil society, of the economy, you know, all at once. And that's exactly what we're seeing here is that kind of playbook.
And Professor Shepley, I'm wondering, it's in your studies, is there any essential or qualitative difference between an autocratic government and a fascist government? Does it even is it even worthwhile to make the distinction? What's your sense?
Yeah, well, so I tend not to be very big on labels in this area, in part because as soon as you define what each of these regimes looks like, someone like Orban, who actually does read and actually is pretty knowledgeable, unlike the U.S. president, who, shall we say, probably hasn't gotten all the way through a book in a long time, Viktor Orban knows what he's doing. And so as soon as you label him something, he will do something that misses, you know, item four on what you have to get the label. So I'm a little nervous about the labels. And, you know, fascism, I think, it also means an ideology. What I'm concentrating on when I talk about autocracy is the system of checks and balances that allows for the future rotation of power and that prevents it from being captured by one political faction. Now, you know, governments that are trying to capture all the levers of power can have all kinds of surface ideologies. Now, what we're seeing is that Trump is even echoing a lot of Orban's rhetoric. So if you think Orban's a fascist, you probably think Trump is as well. But for me, the really crucial thing is, you know, are you eliminating checks and balances? Are you eliminating the things that allow future elections to be free and fair? And what we're seeing, I think, you know, as Trump has come to power with this blitz, with this program, this Project 2025 program, written by private actors, you know, while Trump was out of power, is that he's attacking the nerve centers of American government. I think one thing we've missed is that, you know, the first places that Elon Musk went into were the Office of Personnel Management, so controlling the entire federal workforce, the Treasury controlling all of the payments, as well as the budget, you know, in and out of money, in and out of government, and then the General Services Administration, which controls all the buildings and the facilities, but also all the IT. So they went first into these nerve centers, and we still don't know exactly what they've done there, but it seems as people are trying to figure out what they've done, that they didn't just steal data, but they also did things like put spyware on the computers of people at Treasury. So they're monitoring everything that those people are doing. They're building a kind of centralized dashboard that can be, you know, looked at from the White House and you know, allow the president, or Musk, if he's the ex-president, as I think we should call him, to allow the people in the White House to exercise direct control over federal agencies without going through any intermediaries, any Senate-confirmed appointments, or any checks and balances on the system. Now, you know, Orban did that too. He centralized everything in the office of the prime minister. The cabinet secretaries became, if not irrelevant, then certainly not where the action was. And it's that really sudden and extreme concentration of power that I think we have to keep our eye on and be very worried about.
And can you talk about Orban's role in terms of Project 2025, the Danube Institute, and its relationship with the Heritage Foundation, and also his attempt to become a center for right-wing movements throughout Europe?
Yeah, exactly. So first of all, you know, when Project 2025 came out, I sat down and read it. And the first thing I thought was, you know, this sounds so much like what Orban did. And then it turns out a month later, there was a terrific article in the New Republic that made the connection. So Orban has this English language think tank. It's called the Danube Institute. You can Google it and see what it's up to. And the Danube Institute had entered into a formal agreement with the Heritage Foundation to actually provide consulting on how the Trump people were going to copy what Orban had done. In the meantime, you know, when Orban gives his Hungarian language speeches, one of the things he keeps saying is, you know, we are deep into the Trump administration and, you know, involved in its, you know, central planning. So you put all this together, and it's actually not just that the Trump people are aping Orban from a distance. It's that Orban has actually been involved in the design of Project 2025. Now, this mirrors, you know, what Orban has also done in Europe. So the European elections, the elections to the European Parliament, were held last June, and Orban's Fidesz party spent more money on campaigning for fellow far-right parties in other countries, like not just in Hungary, but in countries all over Europe, than any other single party in Europe. And remember, Hungary is a tiny country, you know, 9.5 million people on the edge of Europe. They're advertising in Germany. They're advertising in France. They're advertising in much bigger countries. And it turns out that this advertising, along with the general, you know, sort of collapse and weaknesses of party systems across Europe, meant that the far right had victories really all over the place. And Orban was able to take those far right victories and cobble together what has become the third largest political party in the European Parliament. And so that's an incredible political accomplishment. And what you're seeing is that Orban is now sort of riding atop this wave of election victories across Europe and claiming to be, you know, the heart and soul of this new far-right movement. He was president of something called, rotating president of what's called the council in the last half of 2024. And when he unveiled his presidency, the slogan was, "Make Europe Great Again," which was also the slogan of this far-right gathering that we just saw in Spain as Orban pulled together all these far-right parties. So, you know, Orban's a prime minister of a tiny country on the edge of Europe, but he is now punching far above his weight in trying to consolidate this movement of anti-democratic far-right forces.
This is Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban welcoming Donald Trump's inauguration last month.
The stars under which we stand now are much more favorable than they were in 2024. Not only we became stronger, but in the meantime, the flagship of the Western liberal politics had sunken. The Western world received a patriotic, pro-peace, anti-migration, pro-family president in Washington.
So if you could respond to what Orban is saying, Professor Shepley, but also one of the things you point out is that you have these authoritarian leaders that don't just take power. I mean, even Hitler won an election. Orban won an election. And then what that process is, consolidating the power, so much so that right now President Trump, what is it, hundreds of executive orders? But isn't that a sign of weakness, not strength? I mean, he's got the House and the Senate. Why can't he pass these laws and not get around them with Republicans in the majority in both houses?
Right. So actually, if you remember, in Donald Trump's first term, he had even larger majorities in both houses for the first half of his first term. And even then, he did not move to legislation. So I think part of the reason is that Trump wants to move fast. Orban also wanted to move fast. You know, Orban, in his first year in office, amended the Hungarian constitution 12 times, changing 60 different provisions of the constitution. Orban had a supermajority in his parliament, so he was able to work with them. Trump has got razor-thin majorities now in both houses. Also, amending the U.S. constitution is beyond the bounds of almost any single political party. So Trump is doing something else, and this is the crucial thing about the autocratic playbook. It doesn't look exactly the same in every country because not the political systems don't look exactly the same. So Trump is trying to break things quickly so that by the time the courts catch up with him, by the time his own party starts to have second thoughts, by the time all of the forces that are checks and balances regroup and figure out how to push back, the thing will be broken. You know, so I think what Trump has learned and what Orban also, I think, taught him is that, you know, think of government as an aquarium. If you just stick a blender in it and make fish soup, you're not going to be able to restore the aquarium, even when courts tell you, no, you shouldn't have done it like that. So this is really, you know, break things first, act fast to create facts on the ground. And then when especially the judiciary is slow to catch up with you, you can't do anything. So let me give you one example from Hungary. In order to capture the judiciary, what Orban did was to suddenly lower the judicial retirement age from 70 to 62. And in Hungary, like most European countries, the judiciary is a civil service activity. So you come in as a baby judge, you get promoted through the ranks. The people who are the oldest are also the most senior. So you suddenly lower the retirement age, effective like today. All these judges are forced out of office. They then bring a lawsuit saying, you know, we were improperly, illegally fired. A couple of years later, the European courts get around to saying, yes, that shouldn't have happened. This is a violation of European law. By that time, Orban's filled all the positions. He goes back to the court and said, well, do you want us to fire the new judges? At which point, the European Commission, which is enforcing this court decision, says, well, we really don't want you to fire any new judges. Just give the new judges protection so that this can't happen again. Okay? And what that meant, he captured all the courts and got European blessing for it all because he moved first, broke things. And this is what we're seeing. You know, Trump is just creating facts on the ground. He'll destroy agencies before the court tells him you have to restore them. So again, the metaphor is you start as an aquarium, you create the fish soup, and no court can make you go back.
We just have 20 seconds, but what about if these federal workers, if the heads of agencies simply refuse to leave, create the constitutional crisis on the other side, the judiciary has to rule, and instead of ruling years later when all these people are gone, they rule now, and the agencies don't get shut down.
Yeah, well, a few of the officials who have been fired have tried to make a last stand. You know, some of the inspectors general did, and the head of the Federal Election Commission did. The problem in Washington is that they can just deactivate your badge at the door. So in Poland, when the judges went back into court after their retirement age was lowered, they could get into the court. But in our government, it's very difficult because the buildings themselves have so much security. But still, I think it's good for people who were in office to say, I'm not leaving until you force me, and just create friction in the system, slow it down, is actually the best defense in circumstances like this.
Professor Kim Lane Shepley, want to thank you for being with us, professor of sociology and international affairs at Princeton University, specializing in the rise and fall of constitutional government with a special focus on Hungary. We'll link to your piece in the Times, Are We Sleepwalking Into Autocracy? Next up, Tarek Ali. We speak to him as President Trump repeats his threat to take over Gaza, not buy it, just have it, and ethnically cleanse the entire population. Tarek Ali's new book, You Can't Please All. Back in 20 seconds. Street Fighting Man by the Rolling Stones is about our next guest, Tarek Ali. Mick Jagger wrote it for Tarek. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is threatened to renew Israel's attacks on the Gaza Strip, saying the Israeli military will return to, quote, intense fighting unless Hamas agrees to release all remaining hostages by Saturday noon. This comes after President Trump said all hell is going to break out if the hostages aren't freed. Hamas has accused Israel of repeatedly violating the ceasefire. Meanwhile, Trump on Tuesday met with Jordan's King Abdullah at the White House, where Trump repeated his threat to take over Gaza and displace the entire Palestinian population. Reporters questioned Trump about his Gaza proposal.
Mr. President, he said before that the U.S. would buy Gaza, and today you just said we're not going to buy Gaza.
We're not
going
to have to buy. We're going to have Gaza. We don't have to buy. There's nothing to buy. We will have Gaza.
What does that mean?
No reason to buy. There is nothing to buy. It's Gaza. It's a war-torn area. We're going to take it. We're going to hold it. We're going to cherish it.
Mr. President, take it under what authority? It is sovereignty.
Under the U.S. authority.
That was President Trump sitting next to a grimacing King Abdullah of Jordan, who later wrote that they will not accept the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, and the
President of Egypt, President Sisi, canceled his trip to the White House next week after these comments. We're joined now by Tariq Ali, Pakistani-British historian, activist, filmmaker, editor of the New Left Review, author of over 50 books, including just out, You Can't Please All, Memoirs 1980 to 2024. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us on this side of the pond. But I do have to ask you, Mick Jagger wrote that Rolling Stones song for you, Street Fighting Man?
Yeah, he wrote it and sent it to me, a handwritten version, saying, could you put this in the paper? I just wrote this for you. I edited a radical newspaper at the time. And the BBC are refusing to play this song. So we did publish the song. And, of course, a few weeks later, the BBC did play it. I mean, that was a time when politics and culture, radical politics, radical culture, were very mixed up together in a good sense.
So let's go back to Gaza. You have President Trump doubling, tripling, quadrupling down, saying he doesn't even have to buy Gaza. He'll have it. He'll take it. He's also said, originally said, the world's people will be there, yes, including Palestinians. Now, no, Palestinians have no right of return. Your response to what's going on there?
It is so appalling, Amy, what is going on now. Trump says it in public, what his predecessors used to say in private, that effectively they're going to let Israel have its way, both in Gaza and, believe you me, in the West Bank. They will both be ethnically cleansed. That has been Israeli policy for decades, and now they feel they've had leaders in the United States. Trump is, of course, shameless and open about it. Biden did exactly the same thing. For 6 months, Hamas had agreed to the ceasefire plan. Netanyahu didn't want a ceasefire, and Biden backed him. So one problem we have today, that the reason you have Trump is because the previous administration was so weak-willed and so weak-minded and incapable of doing anything, whereas in this very country we had Reagan, Bush, Truman calling Israel to heel when they exceeded what was considered to be decent, honorable, according to the United States policies. When they refused to obey, they were called to heel. Neither Biden and now Trump calling these people enough. The whole world is seeing what you're up to. Enough. We will not tolerate it. Netanyahu threatening to break the ceasefire, and the response of the United States president is what? The response is nothing to do with the ceasefire, but we're going to take Gaza. We can. The Israelis have got it for you by killing over 100,000 people, and now we'll do with it as we please. I mean, if this is the way the United States empire is going to carry on functioning, there will be more and more, not immediately, there will be more and more resistance. If even the King of Jordan and Sisi in Egypt, who have so far backed the United States, are getting slightly scared, it's not because they've changed greatly, it's they're scared there will be an uprising in their countries. Jordan is three-quarters Palestinian anyway, and the Egyptian masses are seething. So we have a really extremely serious situation building up in the Middle East, where they publicly, in front of everyone, want to expel the Palestinians. No cover-up. Netanyahu says we're going to do it. The U.S. president supports him.
And Tariq, the famous Palestinian-American intellectual Edward Said was a friend of yours. You write about him in your memoir. Said was prophetic in many ways in terms of his skepticism of the possibility of a two-state solution. What are your sense of how he would have responded to what's happening today?
Well, Edward was a very dear friend. We often discussed Palestine. And he felt, as did many others, that the only serious solution for that region was a one-state solution with equal rights for all its citizens, male, female, Jews, non-Jews, etc. That was the only way we could proceed, because a two-state solution had become a joke. I mean, if you look what's been happening in Gaza for a year, an open genocide. If you see what they're starting to do to the West Bank now, a two-state solution is impossible. No one will believe in it. But a single-state solution has also now become very difficult, in my opinion. It's the worst situation to confront the Palestinians. I mean, 70%, between 60 and 70% of the Israeli population back Netanyahu. You have large numbers of Zionist citizens of Israel coming out and chanting once again, kill the Arabs, just like many German fascists shouted, kill the Jews. What is going on? And the U.S., in my opinion, is completely abdicated its role to be an arbiter. It never was an arbiter, but now that's just become a complete joke. So the situation seems grim to me, and whether it can be resolved simply within the area currently Israel-Palestine, or whether it will have to expand and extend to the rest of the Arab world before people see sense is an open question.
And I'm wondering, as you mentioned the situation in Israel, clearly we just had a segment talking about authoritarianism in Europe as well, the rise of fascist and right-wing movements through, and especially anti-immigrant movements throughout Europe. What is your sense of the role or the problems in terms that the left has had in confronting these movements?
The real problem, Juan, is this, that all political parties, prior to the rise of these extreme right parties that the professor was talking about, prior to that, we had a center-left and a center-right. Both of them supported the economic system we call neoliberalism, a very extreme, rampant type of turbocharged capital, which wrecked the social structure of many of these countries, privatized large industries, entered into the domains of health and most sacred and hallowed sections of the old post-Second World War state. And that collapse, and the fact that parties of the center-left and center-right, whenever they came to power, did exactly the same thing. I wrote a book called The Extreme Center about these groups. They've now been shown to be what they were, which is useless. So there's a great hostility against these politicians, and there is nothing on to the left of them in most places. France is an exception. And what people do now is turn to the right, saying, we've tried all these jokers out. These guys are talking what seems to be our language. Let's see what they're like. And from that point of view, this big turn to the far right, in a sort of curious way, it's fitting that the champion now sits at the White House, the most right-wing president in recent years, especially on the domestic front. So there is a symbiosis taking place between the European far right and the far right government we seem to have got in the United States, and how they will work together. I mean, one problem they have is, and this should be talked about, that Zelensky's government in Ukraine, its hardcore, are not just people who are far right, but they are actual lineal descendants of Ukrainian Nazis who have been fighting. We shouldn't forget that, too. It's part of the picture. Just because the West is backing Ukraine doesn't mean that these things are not going on there. So it's very difficult to give this a gloss. What is happening in the West as a whole is pretty disastrous. It's not just Orban. He's very open, like Trump. Yeah, this is what we're doing. We don't care what you think. We're going to do it. We've been elected. We have the power to do it. There are people like that, but there are another layer of people who supposedly oppose them, who, when it comes down to it, have policies which are not all that different. I mean, what the United States and much of Europe needs today is an opposition which fights back politically, intellectually, with arguments, and when necessary, comes out on the streets, extra parliamentary actions to defend democracy.
We just have 30 seconds. The most important message following up on that rising up at the grassroots you feel people need to hear around the world now from your decades of activism.
I think we need activists more than ever before. I mean, one of the most amazing things has been this opposition by students in this country, occupations of universities in defense of the people, the Palestinians and the people of Gaza. We now need to extend these movements to what is happening domestically.
We're going to continue this conversation and post